60s and 70s, California was the nation's fastest growing state, and developers had extensive plans to build subdivisions, golf courses, polo fields, and high-rise hotels in the Merritt Headlands, Point Reyes, and Bolinas. If it weren't for citizens organizing and fighting to keep these places free from development, the entire Bay Area would look and feel very different. The new documentary, Rebels with a Cause, follows ordinary citizens who did extraordinary things to preserve these natural treasures. So what can we learn from them as the next generation takes up issues like fracking and greenhouse gases? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Nick Kelly. Heavy fighting between government forces and rebels has continued in South Sudan. The United Nations Special Representative there, Hilda Johnson, has said well over 1,000 people have been killed, although the exact number is not known. She said the country, which gained independence from Sudan after Africa's longest-running civil war, must not be allowed to descend back into conflict.
The nationhood, painstakingly built over decades of conflict and strife, is at stake. And for us, one of the most important things is to have those nightmares end. I therefore call on the political leaders of South Sudan to order their forces to lay down their arms and to give peace a chance, and to do so urgently.
African leaders have renewed their efforts to mediate between President Salva Kiir and his rivals. President Kiir has met the Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and the Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn. Reports say they discussed the humanitarian crisis and a possible ceasefire. The Egyptian authorities have arrested at least 16 supporters of the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood, a day after it was declared a terrorist organisation. Those arrested include the son of a deputy leader of the movement, which was thrown out of power when the army deposed President Mohamed Morsi in July. Earlier, a bomb attack on a bus in Cairo injured 5 people. Khalid Ezzelarab reports from Cairo.
The significance of this attack, if it is an explosive device, as the Ministry of Interior says, is that it would be the first attack on a target that is civilian. There seems to be no military or police targets involved in this. It only seems to be a random explosion in this area. A second device was found and defused later by the police forces, according to the Ministry of Interior.
A public prosecutor in Turkey says he has been prevented from carrying out a full investigation into the corruption allegations at the heart of the Turkish government. In a statement, Muammer Akas said the police had obstructed proceedings by failing to carry out some arrests that he had ordered. He added that he had been removed from investigating the case. Istanbul's chief prosecutor, Turhan Çolakkadı, said he had been removed for leaking information to the media. The Thai government has rejected a call from the Election Commission to postpone indefinitely the election due to be held in February. The Deputy Prime Minister, Prongtaip Teipkanjana, said the law would not allow the government to delay the election.
February 2, 2014 was set as the election date in the Royal Decree dissolving Parliament, and there is nothing within the Constitution or the law that gives the government the authority to change this date.
The Election Commission said it believed the risk of violence was now too high for campaigning to take place. World News from the BBC. A Russian cargo plane has crashed in Siberia, killing 6 crew and 3 other people on board. The Emergencies Ministry said the transport plane was heading to a factory in Irkutsk when it fell on a warehouse at a military unit outside the city. It caused a fire, but there were no casualties on the ground. China has summoned the Japanese ambassador in Beijing to lodge a strong protest about the visit of Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to the controversial Yasukuni War Shrine. Mr. Abe is the first serving Prime Minister in more than 7 years to visit the shrine, which honours Japan's war dead, including convicted war criminals. Our correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports from Tokyo.
Shinzo Abe says he went today to pray for the souls of all those who died in World War II and not to honour any war criminals. But few in China or South Korea will accept that. The spirits of 14 Class A war criminals are enshrined at the Yasukuni, the same men who oversaw the brutal invasion of China and the deaths of millions in China, Korea and beyond. For the Chinese and Koreans, there can be no excuse for a Japanese Prime Minister praying at a place that honours such men.
A At least six peacekeepers from Chad have been killed in clashes in the Central African Republic capital, Bangui. A spokesman for the African Union peacekeeping force said they were attacked by a Christian militia known as Anti-Balaka. Christians have been fighting the mainly Muslim rebel movement Seleka, which seized power in March. And Russian forensic experts studying the remains of the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat say he died of natural causes, not radiation poisoning, as his widow suspects. The Russian finding is in line with an assessment by French scientists this month. A Swiss team earlier said it had found unexpectedly high levels of radioactive polonium in his body, although it said it couldn't draw the conclusion that he'd been poisoned. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. So many of us take for granted the abundance of wild open space in Northern California. In almost every direction, there's a park or preserve for everyone to enjoy. And this is what makes the Bay Area especially so special. Every acre of protected land that exists today is the result of a struggle. Citizens in the 50s, 60s, and 70s coming together to take on developers to keep this treasured space open and free. This time in Bay Area history is chronicled in the new documentary, Rebels with a Cause. The film looks back at the battles for Point Reyes National Seashore, Bolinas, the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, and the creation of the Marin Agricultural Land Trust. And here is a clip from the documentary, Rebels with a Cause.
How did they do it? Between the 1950s and the 1970s, when California was the nation's fastest growing state, and cities were gobbling up nearby forests and fields, ordinary people in the San Francisco Bay Area saved a vast stretch of coastline north of the Golden Gate Bridge for parks and farms. Their efforts fostered a national movement to preserve open spaces near where people live.
What happened here is worth sharing because it shows all of the gains happen in incremental baby step ways. Do you know what I mean? They weren't magnificent. You didn't all of a sudden say, here's a 100,000-acre park. It wasn't like that. It was all incremental.
The idea of a national park near an urban center was brand new at that time. A lot of people didn't want it, including the Park Service. The head of the Park Service said, we don't want an urban park. But we were able to start the county thinking about these areas being public and permanent and not part of real estate development future. And that took some doing.
But nobody thought would prevail in it. At the time, we were called conservationists, which is kind of a dirty word. You were in the next step below a communist. And that was true. I think we're kind of rebels with a cause.
And that is a clip from the documentary Rebels with a Cause. Today, we are joined by Nancy Kelly, director of the film Rebels with a Cause. Nancy has been an independent filmmaker for more than 25 years, and she joins us here in studio. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you.
Great to have you, and congratulations. The Chronicle gave you 3 stars, and the little man is clapping.
The little man is clapping.
So that's always good. It's great to have you. We're also joined by Amy Meyer, co-chair of People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area. Amy served as chair of People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area with Dr. Edgar Wayburn, and she's now chair of the organization and author of The New Guardians of the Golden Gate, How America Got a Great National Park. Hi, Amy. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And I have to say, as someone who goes to these spaces and places about 3 to 4 times a week, thank you for your work. Because I actually do my research for the show at Fort Funston on a regular basis.
That's great.
So thank you so much. So it's such a great film because those of us who do love these places do often take them for granted. And Nancy, what really inspired you to look at the history of these amazing treasures?
Well, Nancy Dobbs, who's the president and CEO of KRCB up in Sonoma County, I was in a meeting with her one day, and she asked me whether I would be interested in making a documentary about saving the lands on the Northern California coast. And I immediately said yes, because I'm like you. I love those lands. I'm out there a lot hiking and riding my bike on the roads that go through there. And I knew a little bit of the story from having read a couple of books. So, yeah, I was on board. I didn't tell my filmmaking partner and husband, Kenji. I didn't ask him. I just said yes and committed the two of us to 8 years of work.
Oh, it was 8 years?
Yes, it was.
Because it is so in-depth and extensive, and you were able to get interviews with incredible, well, activists and citizens who really fought to keep these places open.
Yeah, it was really so much fun to research them and interview them, and then spend all kinds of time in the editing room, you know, looking through their interviews and trying to tell the story, and particularly Stuart Udall, who was the Secretary of the Interior under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. When I called him to ask if he would agree to be interviewed by me and my crew, he said no. And I just knew that we needed him to tell the stories of those early days. And I said, Mr. Udall, no, it doesn't really work for me.
Good for you. And just, we're going to go over a lot of the details because they're just so incredible. But when you were making this film, and then, you know, at the end of a wrap or something, you turn on the news and you see what's happening with the struggles over fracking, for example, greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, so many. What really went through your mind as you were learning about how citizens successfully won these battles?
Well, I was really hoping that that these stories from decades ago really would inspire people who were working on climate change issues, for example, to just keep going and to not feel defeated and just feel heartened in some way.
And what would you add to that, Amy? I mean, it's great to, you know, you share the past, and then there are clips of you fighting for space, talking about having an office in your kitchen as you were raising your children. But what is it like for you to tell the story about what happened back then and then look at the struggles that we face today?
It's hard to realize that 43 years have gone by since I started working on this. And it did start, this aspect of it did start in my kitchen. But it started over 12 and a half acres, a little piece of land called East Fort Miley, and it's now 80,000. Mm. And with Point Reyes National Seashore touching it for 10 miles, and with just a break at the Golden Gate, it's in three counties. And the total amount of land protected that's related to this, including the Marin Municipal Water District, we're talking about 200,000 acres or more of contiguous land broken only at the Golden Gate. No urban area has a kind of area of protected land like this. And it's wonderfully exciting and exhilarating to know that it's there.
Well, and what's amazing is in the film you said, we had our first meeting for people for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area on January 6th, 1971. And a 34,000-acre bill was signed by President Nixon on October 27th, 1972.
I mean, that's true.
Can you imagine that happening today?
You know, no, but for sad reasons. This was an entirely bipartisan idea, and its time had really come. There had been resistance from the Park Service originally to the idea of protecting the Golden Gate. Ed Wayburn, who was my chairman during the period, the active period of this, Ed died a couple of years ago. But he and his neighbor, Ansel Adams, had approached the Park Service, and they essentially said, go work at Point Reyes. You know, we don't have, this isn't, you know, something we're going to take up. But it was ready, and a study was done by a branch of the Park Service no longer extant called the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation. And that study yielded a report and support from a firebrand Democratic Congressman, Philip Burton, and a very kind of sedate but very necessary and practical retired Navy Admiral, Congressman William Maillard. And the president at the time, of course, was a Republican. So we needed both of them in their different ways, and they just launched into this, and people said it's now or never because they could see what was happening.
That's the other thing that struck me. When you watch the film, there are a lot of Republicans that sound like today's Democrats. And it's also incredible because in 72, Richard Nixon came to the Bay Area, took a boat ride, loved what he saw, and basically said, if you can get this bill passed, I will sign it immediately.
And we have, you'll see if you come to see the film, that President Nixon is shaking Edgar Wayburn and Amy Myers' hands as he gets off the boat and telling them that. We were so delighted when we found that footage.
Oh, I bet. I mean, and you think about what we're facing today. What else went through your mind when you compare and contrast the two times?
Really, one of the most remarkable things was that Republicans were conservationists.
And proud, publicly.
And proud. And the other thing that was remarkable was Philip Burton's sort of reach across the country, that he had allies all over the place. And we were just in Cleveland at the Cleveland International Film Festival. And one of the people who was on a post-screening panel with me talked about how their nearest national park, which is very close to downtown Cleveland, came to being in that same bill as the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. And they talked about Philip Burton with the same reverence as people here do.
That was a later stage of this, because, as you said, we started with 34,000 acres in 1972. And Philip Burton built up bills, two omnibus park bills, one in 78 and one in 80, that were took in parks and created park and protected areas all over the country. And he was able to do this. There was something for everybody. So when his bills came forward, they passed. And at one point, we were able to say, after those two bills were finished, that he had saved more land in this country than anybody except Teddy Roosevelt, who, of course, could do it by proclamation, you know, quite differently. So
we are joined by Nancy Kelly, director of the film Rebels with a Cause. Nancy has been an independent filmmaker for more than 25 years. We're also joined by Amy Meyer, co-chair of People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area. Amy served as chair of People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area with Dr. Edgar Wayburn, and she's now chair of the organization and author of The New Guardians of the Golden Gate, How America Got a Great National Park. And talk a little bit, Amy, about what it was like back then, because the decision makers were all men, right?
Yes, all men, right. Yes.
But the,
almost.
Okay.
Diane Feinstein got in on this early.
Ah, all right. Well, we'll talk about that, because that's not in the film, but that's really interesting because she's our senator.
And so did Barbara Boxer as a young activist in Marin County. Hmm. Both of them were active in earlier ways. Diane was a supervisor. And Barbara was belonged to one of the activist organizations in Marin and pushed for this.
You talk about being a housewife with young kids and they just started school. And at the beginning or after the beginning of the women's movement, basically women really, they raised their families. Their job basically was to get married and have kids. But I love, there's a great scene where these women actually stop traffic on the Golden Gate Bridge to get signatures. What was that campaign?
They were trying to stop Marin Chela.
Right. And we're definitely going to talk about Marin Chela. But what was that time like for you, Amy? And what got more women to get involved in this movement?
I think I was the beneficiary of a lot of things that had happened, starting with the Depression, the war, the freeing up of women. I mean, it was, after all, the time of Rosie the Riveter during the war, and a whole bunch of women got freed up during that time. There was an emancipation of minority people. Everybody was going to have some power. All you had to do was assert it. The idea that a person could individually make a difference or organize with others to make a difference became much more real and possible during the 50s and 60s, and we got started actually in the spring of 1970 before we had this first meeting in 71. But in 1970, by that time, there were people in the Marin Conservation League, the Sierra Club, and the like. But it's true. Our first superintendent, Bill Whalen, who became the head of the National Park Service, the first GGNRA superintendent, appointed the first woman regional director in the Park Service. Today, when you go and around to Park Service offices, places full of women. But they were certainly weren't when I started on it.
Right, but they did have a voice back then because they were the ones that knew how to organize the communities and get the petitions and get people on board.
That was it, that they were, well, at that early stage, that's what people could do. When I needed help, I could go on my block to ask for help with typing, mailing, sorting. I could ask the Sierra Club people, and the people who turned up were women. 20 years later, when we were doing other things, or 10 years later, one of the people commented, you know, I can't get this help on my block anymore. The women are out working.
Ah, okay. So, that's really interesting. That is Amy Meyer, co-chair of People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area. And she is in the film telling her story about what it was like to fight for this open space that we all treasure and so many of us take for granted. Rebels with a Cause. The director is Nancy Kelly. She made this film with Kenji Yamamoto. And we'd love to hear from you. It's just such an amazing time in our history. What questions do you have about the struggle back then? If you were involved in it, we'd love to hear from you. And as so many concerned citizens deal today with things like fracking and global warming, ocean acidification, there's so much. What can we learn from the successes of this time? The toll-free number is...
You're listening to a rebroadcast of your call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls.
8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Amy, let's talk a little bit about the history, because you were looking for a project to work on. And at the time, in about the 60s, all of these forts, like Fort Riley, for example, were no longer needed. And the Army thought about selling off the land. But there was another plan to turn the forts into preserves and parks.
Well, those changes took place because there was recognition in the Nixon administration that there was a lot of excess military land, meaning no longer useful to the service. And so a study was done in 1969-1970 over 14 areas of the country, much of which was excess military land, particularly our sort of sister park, Gateway National Recreation Area in New York and New Jersey. And it was that excess land that we could look at and say, that not we, but really at that point the government could look at and say, you know, we can do something better with this. I also learned as I researched for my book that Nixon actually had said, you know, I want something in every state in the Union, preceding the 1972 election. I mean, this is, wow, you know, unheard of, but it was from an unexpected source. But that was the attitude he took toward it. So everybody getting behind it, that was something easy to see.
Well, let's hear from a listener. Let's go to Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. I love this show. Thank you so much for doing it. And I wondered, I'm assuming that the women with you know about the women who stopped the bay from being filled in.
Sure.
Back, perhaps they were also inspirational to you, because it is pretty shocking that there was federal money actually allocated to start filling in the bay to use for development, and the women stopped it, and then with much help, of course, and then that money went to the bay model, as I understand it, to prove that it would be a disaster for the bay.
I don't know specifics about the bay model, but I do know that those three women made all the difference. In other words, at that point, the bay had lost at least 25% of its size through filling. And people began to realize this was going to have a disastrous effect on San Francisco, its climate, the whole sense of being in the Bay Area. So their work led to the Bay Conservation and Development Commission and the kinds of regulations we have against bay filling today that has protected us since the early 70s.
And wasn't Sylvia McLaughlin, wasn't she in the last few years up in a tree protesting something?
Yes, she was. And
really?
Sylvia is in her 90s. The other two, Kay Kerr, and I can't quite remember the name of the third woman. I didn't know her. But those people were indomitable. But the idea of women organizing, they certainly were a prototype. The group I worked with, People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area, had a lot of women. It also had a lot of men. The organizations, SPUR, the Sierra Club, the National Parks Conservation Association, were more tipped, you know, toward men in those days. But the local people got out, and one person we could remember with all that collecting of signatures on the Golden Gate Bridge was Margot Patterson Doss, who was an environmental writer here and was instrumental in saving Fort Funston and West Fort Miley from development. The feds had given it to those two pieces to the city, and the city really didn't know what to do with them. But they were not going to be allowed to be developed, and the work she did helped hold them until they could be given back to the federal government. The city had had paid for those pieces, but they gave them back to the federal government. Of course, they're all part of GGNRA today.
You know, the other thing that struck me watching the film, Nancy, is that when we go to these places, you sort of assume, well, it's so beautiful, of course they would keep it open for all of us to enjoy. How could they develop on a cliff overlooking the beach? But, well, that's what they do in Hawaii. I mean, that's what they do all over the place. And can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, the plans were incredibly extensive.
It was really shocking to go into various archives and see the developers' plans. For example, in the Marin Headlands, there was the city of 30,000 people that Gulf Oil and one of America's largest developers were planning for the Marin Headlands, minutes away from the Golden Gate Bridge. And it was surprising that the two ladies with their collecting signatures, Huey Johnson, who was the West Coast director of the Nature Conservancy, and three pro bono lawyers stopped that. I mean, that is remarkable. And anybody who goes out to where the Headland Center for the Arts is now, or Tennessee Valley, that area of hills was going to have like a high-rise building on every single little knob. So it's quite remarkable.
Well, you know, this is something that the New York Times got into. I was astonished to find a clipping that had the New York Times editorializing against Maranchello. Now, in those days, the New York Times didn't have a regional edition. And they said, don't spoil the Golden Gate the way New Jersey spoiled the Palisades, because they could, you know, see that. But this compact city behind the fort lands, made up of ranches that had been put together, was called a new town. And as you say, a couple of minutes from the Golden Gate Bridge, but everybody's going to live and work here, and they won't be wanting to go into the city. And fortunately, by the time we had this proposal, you know, started, the park proposal started, we were able to bring that to the Board of Supervisors in Marin, which said, you know, you're out of your minds, which was very helpful.
They had already approved
an earlier Board of Supervisors had approved it, and the composition of the Marin County Board of Supervisors had changed from 5-0 against conservation until, by the time we were fully into this campaign, it was 5-0 for conservation.
Yeah, it's incredible. It completely flipped.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I'd love to talk after a break. We'll hear a clip about this, actually, part of the audio of the plan to develop the Marin Headlands. But I'd love to also just ask you again, I just keep thinking, what can we do to take these lessons and apply them to what we're facing today? We are joined by Nancy Kelly, director of the film Rebels with a Cause. Nancy has been an independent filmmaker for more than 25 years. We're also joined by Amy Meyer, co-chair of People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area. Amy served as chair of People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area with Dr. Edgar Wayburn, and she's now chair of the organization and author of The New Guardians of the Golden Gate, How America Got a Great National Park. We're talking about the documentary Rebels with a Cause, and we'd love to hear from you. If you were part of this incredible movement in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and fought to preserve these treasures, we'd love to hear from you. What can we learn from their successes when we deal with things like fracking and greenhouse gases? And what questions do you have for Nancy Kelly and Amy, who fought so hard, for Golden Gate National Recreation Center? It's your call. We'll be back after this. ¶¶
listening to a rebroadcast of your call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the new documentary, Rebels with a Cause, How a Battle Over Land Changed the Landscape Forever. The film looks back at the battles for Point Reyes, Bolinas, the Marin Headlands, the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. I mean, the plan was really to develop these areas with high-rise hotels in some cases, polo fields, golf courses, massive subdivisions. But concerned citizens and dedicated citizens came together to make sure these places stayed open and accessible for everyone. And we're joined today by Nancy Kelly. She's director of the film. We're also joined by Amy Meyer, co-chair of People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area. And Amy is in the film talking about how she had meetings at her kitchen table with so many people. And then when her husband came home, they took all the papers out of the kitchen, and then she had dinner ready on the table, like so many women did at that time and today. And let's hear from our next caller. And thanks again, Ruby. Let's go to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I have not seen the movie, and I would very much like to. What I was interested in is I was very involved in a potential class action suit against GGNRA for lack of access, physical access. And some of us went out there and checked out the Marin Headlands and down to Point Reyes. And the access was horrible. The in the gift centers or the community places where you could get, you know, supposedly have questions answered about trails and things like that, the agents there knew little to nothing. And I went with a friend of mine who was blind. I'm physically disabled. I use a wheelchair. And the paths at Marin Headlands were horrible, and none of the items pointing out the different foliage and all of, none of it was in alternative format for my blind friend. And what it came down to is they argued in court to decertify the class. And last I spoke to the attorney who's heading up Disability Rights Advocates, because I was working on it with them, they were arguing for having the class, they were contesting that certification. And so far I haven't learned what happened. I don't know if you do know what happened with any of that.
I'm sorry, I don't.
Nancy?
I don't either.
Okay. Sorry, Ruthann.
All right.
We don't know.
What I can find out.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling, Ruthann. Thank you. And I wanted to find out, we're going to actually be joined by Huey Johnson. Actually, do we have Huey? Okay, great. We have Huey. Huey Johnson is founder of the Trust for Public Land and founder of the Resource Renewal Institute. He served as Resources Secretary under Governor Jerry Brown's first administration. And Huey is also in the film Rebels with a Cause. Hi, Huey. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I thanked Amy, and I have to thank you as someone who enjoys these spaces. Thank you so much for fighting to keep them open. And you played such a pivotal role in keeping the headlands open. Well, what is it like for you to go back and revisit that time?
It's a rich reward for working in a nonprofit organization with limited salary always, and the joy of going back many years later and having a sense the place is now beautiful and will always be that way. I wanted to just make a couple of quick other comments. I've been listening in and enjoying the program so far. Two thoughts. The Save the Bay folks, Kay Kerr and Sylvie McLaughlin and Esther Gulick was a third name, the pioneers who did that. And another question on Barbara Boxer. She was a very active Board of Supervisors member in Marin. And people didn't, I think, realize she'd been there and done that. But she'd been a wonderful progressive there, as she has been in the Senate.
Huey, Barbara, before she got to the Board of Supervisors, was an activist in the very earliest years of getting this park. And that's what I look back to first. She's had a sterling career in supporting this park, you know, all through her terms as a supervisor, a congresswoman, and now a senator.
And look what she has to deal with today. I mean, she has to deal with Republicans who say that God will take care of global warming. And these people are on environmental committees.
It's pretty bad.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. But before we go there, let's talk about the positive. Huey, I just want to play a clip from the film because we were talking earlier just about the fact that so many people don't realize the development plans. We're talking extensive subdivisions in the Headlands, for example, high-rise hotels, golf courses. So let's play another clip that looks at this. This is a clip from the film Rebels with a Cause.
The steep hills and valleys flexing northward from the Golden Gate is considered by many to be the last frontier of open space in Marin County. An ambitious residential development proposal to be known as Marinchello would turn 2,100 acres of the northern hillside into a so-called planned community of high-rise housing units surrounded by open space.
Developer Thomas Fruge visualized this property as home for 20,000 people. Half the 2,100 acres devoted to single-family homes and garden apartments, another 400 acres to high-rise apartments, and the rest to commerce and light industry.
Thomas Fruge said his goal was to make Marinchello the most beautiful plant community in the world.
I had no doubt that if they built the project they were looking at, there would have been other projects on these properties. It would have been just a natural thing to do. If you could politic it once, heck, you can do it again.
And that is a clip from the documentary Rebels with a Cause. The way that they describe that sounds so pristine, right? Garden apartments. It just sounds so nice. And Huey, I mean, if they had gone through with this, Marin would be a completely different place today.
Well, it sure would. And it was significant, not only in Marinchello, but the work that the fellow, Dr. Murray Griffin, who was instrumental early on in blocking a freeway along with others. And I think there's an important element there. Marinchello was only one. The RCA properties, Radio Corporation of America, was pole farmed to 3.5 miles of coastline in Marinchello, and then 1,300 acres that went from Bolinas up to the top of the ridge, and a number of other acquisitions we made. And we, in this context of the close work of a fellow named Peter Baer, Board of Supervisors member, thanking people. I think we need to remember people like Barbara Bastian, who was one of the earliest pioneers in this. I think she's dead now, but did a tremendous job. And another person was Mrs. Gerbode, who had a quiet checkbook. Whenever we needed money, I went over and had a cup of tea with her, and I always came away with a check.
Huh.
And she bankrolled much of what we did. Trips east constantly and other things, as did others for that matter. But it was a complex and wonderful time, and I certainly don't think any one project made it. Marinchello seems to get all the attention, but it was a remarkable coming together of citizenry, people who really cared. Amy certainly deserves a bronze statue up by the bridge someplace. And a whole legion of people. But gosh, I've had many years working in landscaping all over the country professionally, and that Marin success against such formidable odds was good. Even one of the biggest odds was the Park Service didn't even want it.
Yeah, that was incredible. I didn't know that either. The Park Service did not want a park.
They were not ready for it at all.
Well, that was a good reason. The earlier caller and handicap thing, they had realized the problems that would come up with an urban park. And if they could keep all their parks way off in the boondocks, they could control management and be much more comfortable. And they opened up kind of here and a similar one on the East Coast, and it taught them all kinds of new lessons, which they're still getting in dealing with the mass urban public and problems that they're going to have to face more in the future, I guess.
And Huey, we have a question from Frank in San Rafael. He says, I'm confused. Didn't the efforts of John Muir and Teddy Roosevelt protect the open land in Marin and Sonoma? How would private developers get access?
It did not. They didn't even look at Marin. They were looking at millions of acres of public landscape, the Sierras from the Canadian border to the Mexican border, the Rockies from Canada south. They dealt with the Great Plains. They dealt with establishing national parks and huge landscapes. This success was unusual because it was large, but more than that, it was very urban and very expensive and politically loaded. You had a big New York developer and an oil company behind him. That's a formidable enemy to confront. And the fact that the citizenry of the Bay Area did it is what is remarkable about this.
You know, at the, I think the caller has conflated something. Teddy Roosevelt did declare Muir Woods National Monument under something called the Antiquities Act. And the Kent family wanted it, which had pushed for this to happen, asked that it be named for John Muir. But that's about 500 acres. We're talking huge amounts around that. They were mostly military land. Actually, that's the core of this park at the beginning, and then spread out to save areas that where ranching was no longer viable and where we would have had sprawling suburbs. And that's been the basis of how this park was put together.
Well, the other interesting thing is you look at the power of this Gulf Oil Real Estate Development Company. And, Huey, you traveled back and forth to speak with them. There was litigation that dragged on for years. We'll talk with one of the lawyers who volunteered so much of his time to this effort. And this is a funny part in the film. The Gulf Oil lawyers said, well, I'm not really worried about this. Those people are going to run out of money. And what did you tell them?
I told them, well, you're making a mistake here because we have an advantage. Our attorneys work for free, and they're crazy.
Well, this is
a... this is true today. Corporate law will often just wear you down. If you happen to be an environmental critic and you don't want pollution coming down your river, they can carry out litigation for 20 years. It's happening up in Alaska, even still on the oil spill up there, for instance.
Right. And, well, and the amazing Earth Justice lawyers are filing lawsuits on a regular basis. Well, now is a great time to bring in our next guest, Bob Pratzel, who practiced law in Marin 1954 through 2006. In the 60s, he put over 1,000 pro bono hours in to successfully defeat the proposed city and area of Marin Cello in the Marin Headlands. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's great to have you here. So talk a little bit about the power of the lawsuits back then. I mean, there was no restraining order on Marin Cello, so the project did move forward. The bulldozing did begin, but the lawsuits went on for years. How important were they?
I think we eventually stopped the development. We stopped an approved city of 30,000 people. And the reason I got into it is that it was kind of interesting. There were two lawsuits filed. One was for a referendum to bring to a vote of the people, and the second was for zoning, whether Marin had complied with the zoning laws. And the lawsuits were originally brought by two attorneys, Bob Kahn and Dick Briner, and at that time they had a contract with the County of Marin to help with misdemeanors. They were kind of misdemeanor public defenders. After they filed the lawsuits, they were told by the county, if you don't get out of these lawsuits, we're going to practically run you out of the county and you'll be out of business. So they called myself and they called Marty Rosen, this is Bob Kahn and Dick Briner. And then Marty and I decided to enter the case. We later were joined by Doug Ferguson.
And I was just looking at the Earth Justice site about, and I mean, the number of cases that they file is just huge. I mean, I can't even read them, just a couple. Helping communities fight power plant air pollution, cleaning up sulfur dioxide emissions from Homer City, protecting Coos Bay's estuary, protecting Seneca Lake from the gas industry infrastructure projects. Can you talk a little bit about just the importance of the legal system in this fight?
Well, if we had not prevailed, there would have been a city of Maranchello. And it took us about 5 years to overcome the trial court decisions. We lost in both cases in the trial courts, and but we eventually prevailed in the appellate courts. And we lost the first suit in the appellate court, and in the second suit we prevailed, and Gulf went all the way to the top of the California Supreme Court, and they turned him down. So the appellate court had ruled in our favor, so that we prevailed.
And that's Bob Pretzel, an attorney who put in over 1,000 pro bono hours to defeat the proposed Maranchello in the Marin Headlands. We're also joined by Huey Johnson. He's founder of Trust for Public Land and founder of the Resource Renewal Institute. He served as resources secretary under Jerry Brown's first administration. Huey actually gave I have so many notes here. The Gulf Oil Development Company, what was it, $100, Huey? Because that's what you had at the time?
Yep.
Yeah, $100 for that land. We're also joined by Nancy Kelly. She is director of the film Rebels with a Cause, and Amy Meyer, co-chair, People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area, who had meetings on her kitchen table to garner support to keep these places open. And we've got just about 10 minutes left. You can join us at 866-798. You're listening to a rebroadcast of your call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. And let's hear next from Marianne in San Francisco. Hi, Marianne. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
I was one of the women who went to Amy's house and stuck on the stamps and mailed all this stuff.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to hear from you again. It's been a while.
Very happy memories.
Amy, talk about what got you involved and how did you first hear about this?
I went to a neighborhood meeting that Spur had sponsored. A neighbor said, you know, why don't you try it? And I was looking for a project, a little project, because my kids had gone to school full time. My husband was a psychiatrist who was kind of an inward sort of a person. And so I just wanted to get out in the community. The little project turned out to be the biggest one that the area had seen for, you know, many years.
And Marian, how did you first hear about this?
Well, I was a member, and still am, a member of the Sierra Club, and I suppose it was through them. I can't remember exactly the details, but I know that I used to go to Amy's house sticking on stamps and mailing out stuff.
So you remember how we used to take it was actually the dining table, and the idea was that George, my husband, we knew would come home. We could hear the garage door in the backyard, and all of you were so good about grabbing the papers, shoving them in boxes, and getting out the front door, and my husband would walk through the door, and I'd be setting the table.
This is Amy I'm speaking to.
You are.
Oh, how wonderful. I followed you around.
Thank you so much.
Wow. And Marian, when you look back at that time and you look at the struggles we face today, I mean, we had Josh Fox on of Gasland 2 talking about fracking. What lessons can we take from the successes you had back then to what we're dealing with today?
Well, it just takes a little people to do all the donkey work and someone to organize them with the right focus. That's what I think.
In other words, that individual people make a difference. When individual people get together, they can even be more powerful. And you were part of a very powerful movement. You came in and did your part in something that was, fortunately, I always say all the stars were aligned at that time.
Yes,
I mean,
indeed.
So,
those were the days.
Here, the only tool we really have is persistence.
Anyway, Amy, wonderful talking to you.
Mentioned five
Thank you, Marian.
Years. thing is time. Everybody donated their time, but persistence, if you stay in there, big institutions get tired and they can't afford their own legal costs that long. They hire $500 an hour attorneys and so on, and they keep that up a couple of years and they have to start explaining to the board what they're doing.
Well, elaborate on that a bit, because, you know, you've got these massive industries, oil and gas, and, you know, just they have a massive PR machine. So talk a little bit about the differences between then and now, Huey, and what do you tell citizens who are concerned about what we're dealing with today and what actually works?
Well, I think you have to inform enough citizens to bring pressure on politicians. A politician will just jump all over the place if he gets a dozen letters on any subject. And you don't need 5,000 because they don't want to see 5,000 coming in. So they'll act when they get 10 or 12. So citizens group can organize and effectively appeal to and pressure. I think closely working with environmental groups who are well informed, the Sierra Club was mentioned, the legal defense group is doing tremendous work. And they often are an excellent source of information that you can use to borrow and apply to your own local condition. Most often as well is you can be positive and happy about some of these things, you know, invite politicians to social events and thank them for whatever vote they've given you in the past. They remember that, and it's important to maintain their goodwill because you don't want them as an enemy. Sometimes you get them anyway.
And Bob, same question to you. What advice do you give? We're getting a lot of emails actually about this. What advice do you give to today's citizens who are in this struggle?
I think they should keep a lookout, and if they see something that's wrong, they should try to do something about it.
Well, we have an email from Art.
It's not enforced.
I'm sorry?
The laws are often on the books, but if they're not enforced, if somebody doesn't blow the whistle and say, hey, the law says, and you guys are doing the opposite, then they'll get away with doing the opposite.
Right. I mean, whenever we do shows on the environment, Amy, people always say, well, we have the Clean Air and the Water Act, but they're not being enforced.
Unfortunately, this is true. In other words, it takes recognition that the law is being broken, and then it takes enough energy on the part of people who see it to pull together. The changes in working patterns in this country have affected how many people are actually on the ground doing this kind of work.
And how would you answer that question, Nancy?
I think that Huey is right, that writing a letter that's informed and that doesn't just sound like something that you took off of the, you know, a request from Move On or something, that can be really effective.
And getting your facts right, and to be able to line up facts and not to make guesses at them, but to have your statistics, your facts, so that you are persuasive and you come to be, if you are keep doing this, people rely upon you to produce the information they need, and not it helps the legislator as much as it helps further the cause.
I just want to read a few emails. Were Nixon's intentions genuine with regard to the environment? When I think of Nixon, I think napalm and Vietnam and lies. The interesting part of protesting is you take a stand, other people show up and debate your views. In the end, both parties identify a problem and a solution must be resolved. Politics uses good intentions of communities to maintain a job in office. Let us remember that. That's one email. And then Sylvia in Albany writes, yes, the grassroots did it. Lots of volunteers, links with nonprofits, private donations to make the dream a reality. My mom worked for a San Francisco union and stumped for Phil Burton, who had the dream of the GGNRA. So did his wife, Sala, who took over when Phil died. John Burton, still a lively Democrat in state government, was also for the park. And Art writes, there were related struggles during the heydays of the environmental movement that we can learn from. One was the anti-nuke movement of the mid-1970s. So just lots of questions about what we can do today. Anything else to add on that as people take on these issues like fracking and climate change? Keystone? President Obama is going to be here on June 6th. There's going to be a big Keystone rally in Palo Alto.
That kind of thing does have to be built up on a scale. That's very large, and it does require persuading individual legislators. I have a lot of faith and respect for the ones who are here in this part of the country, but an awful lot of concern about people who are in other parts of the country. And that's where national organizations, using some of their muscles, National Parks Conservation Association, Sierra Club, and the like, can reach into states that are whose legislators may feel that they are hemmed in.
When we were in Cleveland at the Cleveland International Film Festival recently, someone in the audience asked whether people in California were somehow different in being able to make these things happen. And I think that in Ohio, they don't. Their governor isn't a very good conservationist.
We have a history here. Actually, I joke that when we put this park together, GGNRA together, we were connecting the dots of work that had been done starting in 1870 in San Francisco, 1908 in Muir Woods National Monument, 1920s in Mount Tamalpais, 1960s in Point Reyes, that all we had to do was connect those pieces, and we would have this very large park. And it's a point of view that is hard to find in other places.
That is Amy Meyer, co-chair of People for a Golden Gate National Recreation Area. Be sure to check out her book, New Guardians of the Golden Gate, How America Got a Great National Park. Nancy Kelly is director of the film Rebels with a Cause. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our last Friday Media Roundtable of the year. And this week, we'll have a conversation with a panel of veteran journalists and media advocates about the state of press freedoms in the United States. We'll also talk about the state of economic reporting and talk about some of the biggest stories of the year. We'll be joined by McClatchy's Mark Seibel, freelance journalist Paul Mooney, and media advocate Robert McChesney. Tune in to the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.